Hello and welcome to More or Less on the BBC World Service. We're the programme that takes a critical look at the statistics that shape our world, and I'm Tim Harford. Scotland's largest city, Glasgow, has a rich cultural heritage, but there are areas of real deprivation. It recently drew unwelcome attention from Fraser Nelson, the editor of the British magazine The Spectator. Here he is on Question Time, a current affairs show in the UK.
The life expectancy in some parts of Glasgow is less than it is in Rwanda, and it's shocking. I always thought back then,
it's clearly meant to be a stark comparison, giving the impression that there are parts of Glasgow where average life expectancy is worse than in a country known for a bloody genocide in the 1990s. But a group of fact-checkers based in Scotland, the Ferret Fact Service, looked into Fraser Nelson's claim, and we invited one of them, Alistair Bryan, onto the show to tell us whether the comparison was fair to Glasgow, and for that matter, to Rwanda.
I think there's a few problems with the comparison that was made. One, I think that from our research, we couldn't find an area where life expectancy was lower than the current life expectancy in Rwanda.
I should ask, by the way, what is the life expectancy in Rwanda at the moment?
Well, according to the National Institute of Statistics of Rwanda, it's 69.7 for women and 65.8 for men in 2020. That's their projection.
But OK, so high 60s. What was your other objection?
Comparing a whole country with a tiny area can only really be misleading, because obviously within local areas, the statistical breakdowns of different areas of Glasgow, there are some statistical breakdowns that are very, very small areas. We're talking like in the low thousands of people, particularly the less up-to-date statistics. Like, there was a really widely stated statistic of the life expectancy of an area in Glasgow called the Carlton, where life expectancy was stated as for men as 54, which was widely reported in newspapers in the mid-2000s and was seemingly skewed by a number of specific local issues. So some hostels which were in that area, which looked after adults with various drug, alcohol, mental health problems, which inevitably meant that there was clusters of deaths which brought the life expectancy way down.
I see the objection, but I am a bit confused, Alistair, because you said on the one hand that you weren't able to find an area in Glasgow where the life expectancy was lower than in Rwanda, but you've also said that there is this area called Carlton.
Well, the Carlton statistic that I mentioned is an estimate that comes from 20 years ago. The life expectancy in Glasgow now overall, using statistics from 2017 to 2019, is 78.5 for women and 73.6 for men, which is still very low, but it's not quite as low as some of the widely quoted statistics in the media over the past 20 or so years. And I think that these eye-catching statistics, they endure, and people continue to think that the same thing is true 20 years after the fact.
Are there any areas of Glasgow that stand out as having much lower life expectancies than that?
The more sort of recent figures from the National Register of Scotland showed the Glasgow Maryhill and Springburn Parliament, Scottish Parliament constituency, has the lowest life expectancy of any Scottish constituency. The men's life expectancy there was 71.4 and the women's was 76.8. So that's very low, relatively speaking.
And this comparison with Rwanda makes me realise I don't actually know much about Rwanda in 2021?
Well, Rwanda has a sort of enduring reputation, maybe in the West, that because of the civil war, it would have a particularly terrible life expectancy. Obviously, in the 90s, its life expectancy was in the late 20s. But since then, there's been significant improvements in overall life expectancy, and the combined figure for men and women in 2020 was projected at 67.8 years, which puts it, you know, among the sort of higher end of life expectancies in Africa. So it's possible that using a country like Rwanda, which has this enduring, potentially enduring myth of a war-torn country, leads us to the wrong impression both about Rwanda and about the current situation in Glasgow.
Thank you to Alistair Bryan from the Ferret Fact Service. You're listening to More or Less. Last week, we looked at the argument around the effectiveness of rapid mass testing using what is known as a lateral flow test. One of our loyal listeners, Trish, has written in with a question. She writes, "From what I understand from the Zoe symptom app, losing your sense of smell is a reliable indicator of coronavirus. In contrast, the rapid flow test is not reliable. Statistically speaking, would it not make more sense for people to be given some strong smells with their eyes closed than to do the rapid flow test? And it would also be significantly cheaper. The Zoe app that Trish is referring to is the result of a weekend's brainstorming last March by a group of tech, science, and medical geeks. They came together to refashion a diet app into a COVID logging app, where people who catch COVID input information about their symptoms. And since then, it's really taken off. Joanne Capdevilla is the data science team lead at Zoe.
In a period of 2 weeks, we went from 0 users to more than 1.5 million users. Currently, we have more than 4.5 million users across UK, US and Sweden.
The app is a really good example of how citizen science projects can provide effective data alongside more official sources. In fact, Joanne has regular meetings with British government officials, offering advice on things such as new potential hotspot areas. And it was through the Zoe app symptom logger that it first became clear that loss of smell and taste was a symptom particular to this new virus. It turns out that the coronavirus binds to a protein that is particularly abundant in the cells in your nose and in your mouth, and so it masks your ability to smell and taste normally. So, could what the Zoe app tells us about loss of smell help replace mass testing, as our listener Trish suggests?
What we've seen with the loss of smell and taste, also known as anosmia and analgesia in clinical terms, is that they are very specific to COVID. So if you have these symptoms, you are very, very likely to have COVID. So we see a specificity of 99% over the first week of symptoms. I think that that's the first thing to highlight. And the second thing, which is less positive, but I think still very interesting, is that in the first week, about 48% of the people who have symptoms and have COVID experience loss of smell. So it's a good indicator to determine whether you have or not COVID, but it doesn't find all the COVID cases, especially during this first week.
So what you're saying is almost everybody who loses their sense of taste and smell has COVID, but there are lots of people who have COVID who don't lose their sense of taste and smell.
Yeah, that's right.
I immediately see a flaw in Trish's plan to screen people by seeing whether they still have their taste and smell, because it would miss a lot of people. Do we know when the symptoms come on? Is there any advance warning?
What we are able to track with the symptom logger is the important symptoms during the first few days of the disease, like, for example, from the first 72 hours. And what we see is that anosmia is less important than other symptoms. So there we see like headaches, fatigues, sore throat, which are much more prevalent, so which are much more common among people who had COVID, with sensitivities up to like 60-70%. These are early signs of the disease. And later in the disease, we see like around like day 5, day 6, anosmia, loss of taste and smell, peaking and having much more prevalence than other symptoms.
So sadly, it's basically no use whatsoever as an advanced warning. It's not going to help people to know that they should isolate. But it's very good after the fact. If you did lose your sense of taste and smell, then you know why, it's COVID.
Yeah, I think that if you have it, you should definitely self-isolate. And you want to continue with the test, but I think it's a good sign that you are very likely to have COVID.
Joanne Capdevila, the head of data science at the Zoe app. That is all we have time for this week, but if you'd like to get in touch, do please email moreorless@bbc.co.uk. We will be back next week. And until then, goodbye.